Dax White is managing partner with the White Law Group. He joins in the podcast today. We're talking fraud.
And now, Money Matters USA with Fred Sage.
You also need to work with your advisor to create multiple income streams.
You're at the right place for information every week regarding all the components of a successful retirement plan.
Asset allocation is really a driving force of how much your accounts are going to grow.
Fred Sade is a financial fiduciary and retirement specialist.
I have to put the client's interest ahead of my own pocketbook at all times. I must be able to justify why I'm making the recommendations.
Money Matters USA with Fred Sade. Fred Sade.
Hello, welcome once again into the podcast Money Matters USA with Fred Sade. Fred Sade is founder and managing director of this fiduciary firm of the same name and also holds a PhD in economics from Duke University. We talk about so much here, usually, of course, centered around retirement planning because that is Fred's area of specialty and expertise. We're going to bring in a bit of a twist here. We're going to talk about investment fraud. You may be surprised to learn how there are ways to recover. Fred, you have a special guest, and he is Dax White. Dax is managing partner of the White Law Group, which you can learn more about, and we'll give this again at their website, whitesecuritieslaw.com. So, Fred, we've got an interesting topic to get into today.
Yeah, we do, and I think it's an extremely important topic because there is so much money available and invested in individual IRAs, 401ks, money purchase plans, brokerage accounts. And we have a lot of small investors who are in the market. This type of market always scares me because, in fact, I was listening to was in the car on Friday. And I heard the head of options trading at Hong Kong Shanghai Bank, HSBC, talking. And she said that 50%, and I was stunned by this, that 50% of options trades are being done by small investors. And they're investing options very optimistically, very aggressively, that is long-dated calls and bull spreads. And she was concerned about how aggressive the small investor is. And that's the kind of thing that can get you into trouble if you guess wrong on the direction. It's relatively easy for people to be fooled. And I look at Dax as a tremendous resource in helping people be able to deal with significant losses in their portfolio. Human nature is what it is. Dax, would you chime in here and talk about some of the things that you do to protect the small investor? Oftentimes when they've been burned and they come to you and say, what can I do?
Sure. First off, thanks for having me on, guys.
Pleasure.
I appreciate that introduction. And it's interesting that you mentioned that because we do get a lot of phone calls from people who fall into that category where they're sort of out there investing on their own and wish there were, after the fact, more safeguards that existed. I'm talking about some of the independent online broker dealers. And unfortunately, for what we do and how we're able to help clients recover investment losses, there's rarely anything we can do for those people. You know, the online brokerage firm is sort of the Wild West where if you want to take a bunch of risk, they'll let you sign here, here, and here. But the important part and sort of the fundamental difference between those individuals and the types of people that we represent is that there's not really any advice that's being provided. And so there's therefore not really the same duties that exist between your online broker versus, say, your more traditional wirehouses like a Morgan Stanley or Goldman Sachs or Wells Fargo, et cetera. So for those people, be careful because your litigation options are going to be more challenging. It's not that those cases don't exist. I've seen situations where online broker dealers were allowing someone who had dementia to continue to trade options.
Oh.
And it exists. They're still difficult cases, though, because those people are not dealing directly with a specific individual who would have the ability on a sort of call by call basis over a period of time to recognize, you know, this person's not quite the same person that they were a year or 2 years ago. And maybe they have diminished capacity and maybe I need to escalate this, you know, up the totem pole here. Because with the online broker dealers, you're talking about each time they call in to and that's if they call in. I mean, a lot of times you're just doing it online. But if they call in, they're probably talking to a different person each time who doesn't know how, you know, coherent they are, how they sounded a year ago, et cetera. So it's those types of trading. Again, we get a lot of those calls. And in many cases, there's nothing we can do for those people. The ones that we deal with is more sort of the intersection between a financial advisor's greed and their ability to sell something to clients. And again, that would fall into either, you know, more the traditional wirehouse or even the independent broker dealers. I'm thinking of Cetera that has 10,000 financial advisors. I'm thinking of LPL that has 10,000 financial advisors plus. And those are different platforms where you are dealing directly with one individual on a consistent, prolonged basis. And through the nature of that relationship, certain duties are created where if they are making recommendations that are inappropriate for you, they would have liability and responsibility potentially for that. And there is a platform that exists for exactly those types of disputes. It's exclusively what we do. And that platform is called FINRA arbitration. And for some investors, they might even remember its previous acronym, which is the NASD. That would go back into maybe the mid 2000s, or, you know, the aughts, I guess it would be called. But the NASD, there used to also be the NYSE, and they merged at a certain point, became FINRA. And FINRA is the regulatory body that governs and reviews FINRA registered broker dealers throughout the country. And in addition to having this regulatory component where they actually go in and perform audits and, you know, make sure that the firms that under their purview are following all the applicable rules. But in addition to that, they also have this arbitration process that exists for individual investors who have claims directly against either their financial advisor or their broker dealer. And that's a process that, you know, in terms of coming on and wanting to talk to your audience, that's a process that I just wish more people were aware of. A lot of people that we talk to, you know, they lose money in the market and they just kind of think they have to take it on the chin and chalk that up to a life lesson and move on. And in some cases that may be, but in other cases they may have an actionable claim where there is this process that exists that would assist them in trying to get some of that money back.
You know, one of the things apropos of that, you know, in looking at the FINRA regulation in regard to suitability, risk tolerance, it's always disturbed me that there isn't a time limit on a risk tolerance questionnaire. Because risk tolerance is not carved in stone. It's variable. It can change over time. And experience in talking with someone not too long ago, in which he told me that the firm he was dealing with, they did the risk tolerance questionnaire once, came out of legal, so it wasn't as psychometric as it ought to be, in my opinion. But they only did it once, and he'd been with them for 10 years. And I said, haven't they ever redone it, suggested to you that it be redone? And he said, no, they have not. So I said, so when you open a trading account as opposed to a tax-deferred account, they haven't run you through another questionnaire? No. So what's your take on that?
Sure. We talked about this a bit before we got going. I mean, we obviously deal with the worst of the worst. So this is largely an industry where financial advisors care about clients, look out for their clients, try to do the best that they can for clients. But we deal with the whatever you want to, the bottom 1% where you're not seeing that. And I 100% have seen dozens and dozens of examples of exactly what you're talking about. And of course, the problem with that, you know, and just to sort of touch on the other suitability considerations that should be taken into account by a broker. I mean, we're talking your age, your investment experience, your income, your net worth, your objectives, and those things are fungible. They change. And so absolutely, what you wanted when you were 55 years old, still working, maybe at the peak of your income potential over the course of your career, is dramatically different than 10 years later. And now you've retired. Maybe you've got some health considerations. Maybe your needs have changed. Mm-hmm. You know, so we see that all the time. We see it where, and again, just to give you concrete examples, they fill out the form 10 years ago, but 2 years ago, they were diagnosed with cancer. They quit working. Income needs have dramatically changed. Now they need to be drawing on their portfolio in order to keep up with medical expenses. That's a different person than absolutely, who filled out the form. And the reason that form matters, what we're talking about is the new account form. So if you've ever established a relationship with a broker dealer in the United States, you filled this out. And in litigation, it becomes by far and away the most critical document in the case. And the reason it matters, in addition to that information all being flushed out, and some of these new account forms are much better than others, because there have been situations where we've seen where they don't even get that basic information, and they're sort of relying on the broker made recommendation. Yeah. But the reason it matters is because when a supervisor is monitoring the financial advisor who's made a recommendation, that's the document that they go and look at. They don't know their broker's clients, all of them. They may not know any of them. And so when a, let's say it's a large purchase of a variable annuity or a large purchase of a non-traded REIT or an oil and gas limited partnership, whatever it is, they're going to go back to that new account form and go, okay, the broker is recommending that they put $200,000 into this investment that I know to be high risk. So let me go to the form to make sure this is a person who can handle that risk, wants that risk, can afford to lose their money. And so they're looking at that initial new account form. And to your point, it might be completely out of date and completely inapplicable to who you are as an investor in that moment. But that's the document they're going to look at. So if they're doing it right, then absolutely, that's information that should be updated on a relatively periodic basis, for sure.
We updated, this is what we do as a firm. We updated every 2 years on your every 2 years at your annual review. We put you through the risk tolerance and risk capacity testing. And right now, the last 4 years, we use the Rextrema, Rextrema system, and we use theirs. Previously, we used a company in Australia called Finometrica, and their process is very long, very complicated, and that kind of turned some people off. They have a 25-question and a 50-question questionnaire. We wound up using the 25 questions, not as good, but at least we at least got a current snapshot of where a person was at in terms of all the things that you have discussed.
It's super important, just so that the financial advisor can understand who their client is, and that's a root of what suitability is. It's the FINRA know your customer rule, but when you actually get into the context that I deal in, where now we're talking about litigation, I guarantee you that every defense lawyer that we've ever gone against wish they had a new account form like you're talking about, where there was a bunch of information, because it's really easy for an unsophisticated investor to put down information that they don't necessarily understand or why they're being asked. And then we see it a lot where the form was actually pre-typed in and the client just gets, you know, FedEx envelope, you know, here's a sticky that tells you where to sign it. Right. And they don't realize why the financial advisor wanted it to say that you're aggressive, wanted it to say that your net worth is considerably higher than it actually is, wanted it to say that your investment experience is completely different than what it actually is. And you get into litigation and those become huge critical facts where I have to now prove that that information wasn't correct. And the reason that the investor didn't catch it is because of the way it was presented to them. Or maybe there are certain times where the clients will testify, I think it was blank when I gave it back to them. And I think they filled it in afterwards. The information is critical. And again, I guarantee you the defense lawyers wish that it wasn't just like, hey, fill this out. It's more of a questionnaire that allows you to describe who you are. And through the nature of those answers, it actually tells the firm what you're looking for, what your objectives actually are. Because it is difficult, I think, for people to say, okay, where do I fall on the spectrum? Am I aggressive? Am I moderate? Am I conservative? Am I somewhere in between? But if you answer a bunch of questions about what you actually want, when do you actually need this money? What are your goals? Like, that's going to inform who you are actually.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, we agree with you 1,000, percent. Sometimes we'll have someone say to us, okay, this is where, first of all, I will say, this is not a test that you're trying to ace. Don't try to beat the test. Just be truthful. And once you're truthful, then we'll see how this breaks out and what this actually means for you. I've had people tell me, I heard about or I read about or somebody said, and I want to do this. And then, you know, we'll put it into the software and we'll see how it affects them. And it may be so aggressive that it's just off. It's 100 on a scale of 0 to 100. And we have to say, what happens if this doesn't work out? Okay. And you lose the entire investment and there's no recovery from it, or the recovery is so long into the future that it's not going to make any difference for you. Are you willing to lose whatever, let's say it's $100,000 or $150,000. If you lose that, what's that going to do to your portfolio? What will it do to your retirement? What will it do for your income, for your assets? How will it affect your spouse and so on? And usually they stop at that point, or if they make the we'll find out about it at some later point. But for the most part, they usually stop. But your point where people are unadvised, where they don't want an advisor and they don't think an advisor is going to do anything for them, that's when it's the Wild West. And then it becomes very, very difficult to, as you point out, to help them because they're not open to being helped.
Correct.
Dax White joins in. He is a managing partner with the White Law Group, and you can learn more at whitesecuritieslaw.com. Learn how to protect yourself from the fraud and then also possible recovery strategies. whitesecuritieslaw.com. More with Dax and Fred on Money Matters USA straight ahead.
Are you losing sleep over market volatility affecting your hard-earned retirement savings? You can't afford to lose a big portion of your nest egg with not enough time to recover. Many people want safety and the guarantee of principal, but also prefer the potential of higher growth with the market. And now you can have both. Call Fred Sade at Money Matters USA at 800-593-8188. That's 800-593-8188.
We're back with Money Matters USA and Fred Sade. Fred Sade is the founder of the firm Money Matters USA, PhD in economics from Duke University, and many years in the financial arena. We're talking fraud today on the podcast with Dax White, who is joining in as guest managing partner with the White Law Group. And the website where you can learn more about the White Law Group is whitesecuritieslaw.com, whitesecuritieslaw.com. I actually had a question for you, Dax, in and talking. And now with a lot of people turning to AI and, of course, robo-advising, it may not be malicious intent, but do you anticipate heightened cases of maybe not even necessarily fraud, but flawed advice and strategies? Sure.
Yeah, and I think the SEC is struggling right now with sort of how to regulate this, because this would be sort of a new animal where you're not looking to hold an individual responsible for making either a negligent recommendation or maybe even an actual fraudulent recommendation. You're talking about systems, and you're talking about sort of algorithms that make mistakes because of the input of data, and sort of figuring out, you know, how that then causes problems on the output side. And again, the SEC, you know, they've taken some recent actions against firms like Coinbase, where, you know, they're trying to play catch up here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I certainly remember when, you know, you had the GameStop mania, and yeah. You know, you saw these ridiculous huge spikes in the trading,
right?
And you knew there was more to the story. That is a very difficult area to regulate. And it's certainly going to be a very difficult area for firms, because they have their own, even going back to the online broker dealers that we talked about before, where you've decided that you can do this yourself and you want to individually trade. Those firms are still managing the trading of thousands and thousands of individuals, and they have their own capital requirements internally, where we get these calls. People are pissed off because the trading was halted and they were up and they weren't able to get out before trading resumed, and they're mad at the firm for it. And again, from the firm's perspective, it's their own risk management internally saying, right, hey, like, this has moved against us and we don't have the capital. Like, we need to,
right,
we need,
exactly,
you know,
right. Yes.
And it is definitely a burgeoning problem. But again, going back to sort of what we do for people versus what you're talking about, the challenge of that is it's all disclosed. So when you set up an online brokerage account that says, hey, I want to do this type of trading, they tell you, it might be in the fine print, but they tell you, like, hey, we can halt trading whenever we want. Mm. We can reject trades whenever we want. And so the people who call us, like, the burden of proof is beyond just sort of like, hey, I wanted to keep trading, they wouldn't let me. It's like, well, but they told you that might happen. Or, right, you know, they did a margin call and they only gave me 20 minutes to respond to it. So, yeah, and they told you that too. Those are difficult cases. And it's an increasing problem, because, you know, the what I took away from the GameStop was, particularly for the younger generation, is sort of the gamification of investing.
Right.
They've made it fun. They've made it like gambling, where you're just sort of on the app.
But it's real money here.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
And when the market was going up, it was a blast for these people. I still remember I had a mediation, I think it was San Diego, and my Uber driver, who couldn't have been more than 21 years old, was talking about how he made a couple $1,000 and something. It may have been GameStop or one of those games. And he was like, what do you think I should do? I said, I think you should sell. I said, you know, I don't know when this ends, but when it does, the people who usually lose money are not hedge funds. They're not VCs. They're not private equity. It's usually the people who don't really know what they're doing, but it's fun while it lasts. It exists. It's definitely out there. It's a problem.
Yeah. Well, that is the problem when people who are not sophisticated but think that they are trying to go against the pros, and you cannot beat the pros. You're not going to beat them. You are going to lose. You are fodder, for them. So you better understand, you know, what you're doing. And just because you're reading, you know, a financial publication or something that talks about this, that, or the other kind of thing, that does not make you a professional. You're up against real pros. So, for example, when we have people who want to get into heavy duty, you know, options investing, and their risk tolerance and risk capacity shows that they can handle that kind of thing, we send them right out to firms that do nothing but that kind of work. That's, you know, it's one thing for me to understand it, you know, and follow it, but it's quite another thing when you're working with somebody's money, and there's a lot, you know, at stake when you're talking about large amounts of, you know, of money, or even on commodities trading. Again, I understand it, but I wouldn't do it. And send, you know, you send people out. I have no reluctance or inhibition in saying that this is over my head, and I may understand it from a textbook, but it's not something, you know, that I would feel that it's appropriate for me to do. It's like, you know, it's like that funny commercial that's on TV where the guy is going to give himself brain surgery and he's got the book open. You know, he's gonna open his well, mouth. I mean, it's exactly the way I feel.
Yeah, but Buffett has said that he can count on one hand the number of people that he would trust to consistently outperform the market, and he would only trust them with a certain amount of money.
Right.
If you give them, they can find a market inefficiency, but if you give them too much money, then it doesn't move the needle to outperform the market. So like it can only be a limited amount. But the larger point is that it is really hard to consistently beat the market, and that you are trying to beat the market with worse information. The hedge funds pay for this information. They, you know, they spend a fortune to make sure they know it before you know it. It is a challenge, and you're right. So for the people who are out there doing it on their own, I mean, my dad went through this where he had friends. This has been years ago now, probably pre.com, but he had a bunch of friends who thought they knew what they were doing and retired in their 50s to trade, and it went great right until it didn't. Because it's easy to make money when the market goes up. Everyone thinks they're great at this, but when the markets go bad, that's when whether it's to have someone you're leaning on to make sure that you're doing it right, or whether or not it's just understanding allocation, but you know, diversification is king for a reason. And there's no way of accurately predicting everything that's going to happen. And so again, going back to the litigation side of it, that's what I think we do well for clients. I mean, you know, my background is I've worked at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. I worked at a broker dealer. Like, what I enjoy is reviewing the portfolio and trying to put myself in the shoes of the financial advisor and determining whether or not what they did was appropriate. And we were talking about this during the break, where we'll get calls and the person has, let's call it a $4 million portfolio, in a year where the market's down 25%, they call us because they're pissed off that they lost $1 million. And it's like, yeah, that's a huge amount of money. But what you're talking about are market losses. And that's different than talking about what's actionable. It's different than talking about how, hey, this would have been suitable for me. And I actually, instead of the market being down 20%, I'm down 50%. And I dig into that portfolio and look at, you know, where were they over concentrated? What was the mistake? And again, whether it's professional negligence or whether or not the mistake was, oh, well, this product that I put 20% of your money in, that paid me a 7% upfront commission. So that's why I sold that. You know, because we see a ton of that. But, you know, the part that I think that I enjoy and that I think that we do pretty well is really digging into that portfolio and distinguishing between losses and actionable losses, because they're fundamentally different things.
You're right. The thing that really upsets me very much, and I hear this from even on you know, the sophisticated stations. I won't mention them, but you can guess who I'm talking about. They have guests on who are professionals, you know, pros of the pros, and they, I feel, deliberately conflate the volatility with risk, and they make no effort to explain that they're different. And I think, from my perspective, without getting into a detailed conversation about what risk really is. For me, the simplest way to understand risk for the average investor is to say, when you've thought of everything that you can think of that can go right or go wrong, risk is the one thing that you didn't anticipate, and that's the thing that could happen. And to me, that's not a textbook definition of risk, but it's a simple way to understand risk. So when, things are flying high, as you point out, everything is wonderful. But all of a sudden, when things change and the market does move in cycles, then all of a sudden is, why did I lose money? But you're in an auction market to start with. So what do you expect? You're going to win and you're right. going to lose.
No, the good investors, and we're talking the pros here, they sit around and wait for those opportunities. There's probably a reason that Buffett's sitting on $130 billion in cash yeah. right now. But yeah. to highlight your point, the difference between risk and volatility, and we were talking about this during the break as well. But we have these, we see this a ton of in cases that we have, and they're high commission, upfront commission products. They're illiquid. Yeah. They're called alternative investments, and that's sort of a catch-all for anything that requires a Reg D private placement to be filed with the SEC as an exemption to a regular registration. But the commonality between them, and again, we're talking oil and gas limited partnerships, we're talking non-traded BDCs, non-traded REITs, but the commonality is that they're all illiquid, they all pay huge commissions, and they're all super risky. But to your point, the other thing that makes them so unique is that they don't have to update price very often. There's rules that basically say that they only have to update the share price for investors 18 months after they finish selling it. But if they go to a bunch of independent broker dealers and say, hey, we want to sell $100 million and here's your allotment, and that might take 3 years, and then the clock doesn't start until the end of the 3 years. So you're talking a 4.5 year period where investors are getting on a very risky investment. They're getting a quarterly statement that tells them that their investment hasn't changed one bit. And so I remember the 2008, 2009 market explosion or implosion. We were getting calls as late as 2012, 2013, because these were people who had huge concentration levels in alternative investments that they believed in 2008, 2009, that they had the best financial advisor in town because they weren't seeing any volatility. They were seeing that it was worth exactly what they paid for. And they're like, this is great. Yeah. And I'm still getting my distribution. Like, this is incredible stuff. But as you said, the connection between volatility and risk wasn't there because that was just a market rule that the SEC established. And so it's 2012, 2013, where suddenly the firm is required to update the pricing, and they see that unbeknownst to them, it's not worth $10 a share anymore. It's been slowly declining this entire time period. Right. They just didn't have to tell you. And now it's worth, $4 a share or whatever the case may be. So there's no connection between the two. There is a connection between risk and return, risk and reward, and I wish more people understood that. But risk and volatility, absolutely not. There's a lot of stuff that I wish investors knew so that they wouldn't have to call me. Obviously we're a for-profit business, so we'll take the cases that we can, and we do the best that we can for clients. But in many cases, there's just basic information that I wish people had, because if they had it at the beginning, they probably wouldn't be in a situation where they're needing to call someone like me.
That's true. I know that you're a great advocate for FINRA's broker check. Could you say something about that?
Yeah, that's the biggest one. I mean, there's if you go to our website, we've got pages and pages that talk about red flags, things that should sort of set off alarm bells to you. I mean, obvious ones would be, the broker stops returning your phone calls. You're seeing transactions in your account that you don't remember discussing. I mean, there's lots of red flags. But going even before that, in terms of just making sure that, because again, the vast majority of financial advisors care about you as a person, want to do right by you, look at the fiduciary duty between them and you as something that is really important to them. So most of them are going to do right by you, but Some of them aren't, and that's the ones we deal with. And the FINRA broker check that you mentioned, that's an online resource that is available to everyone, publicly available information at FINRA.org. And if you look at the top of the website, right there in the middle is going to be something that says broker check. You click on there and you can literally type in the name of any financial advisor that you're considering going with, or you could even type in the name of someone you're currently with, but you're a little bit worried about and you're wondering if I should, you know, make a change here. But it's an incredible resource that just most people don't know about. And it's this publicly available report that will literally tell you, have they ever been sued? Have they ever declared bankruptcy? Have they ever been criminally charged? How did they do on their licensing exams? How long have they been in the business? What firms have they been at? I mean, it's just got, we were joking before we got going. It's got information you would never know about your doctor, information you would never know about your lawyer, but it's right there on the FINRA website. And we get calls from clients who call in saying, hey, I was invested with, you know, Joe Schmo, and we're literally looking them up while they're talking to us. And they think, you know, we're like magicians who know all the stuff about every financial advisor. And all we're doing is, I mean, some of them we've dealt with before, but for the new ones, I'm just going to the FINRA website, pulling the report. And it's usually like a 10 or 20 page document, depending on how many times they've been sued. But it lays out everything. And for the ones where there are lawsuits, if you're with someone where you're worried about it and you're thinking, you know, it is what he's recommended, he or she recommended to me, something I should be worried about. If they've been sued on it, it'll actually detail the list of allegations, the investments that are at issue in the claim. And you might look at it and go, oh my gosh, that's exactly what I'm dealing with. It's an incredible resource. It's one where I wish more people knew about it. And I feel like at least of the people that we represent, it's very rare that they have any idea that it exists. And I, you know, for those financial advisors who've got, and we've seen this, you know, 60 plus customer complaints. And it's like, you just know that if the people who invested with this person knew about FINRA or a broker report, you know, there's a point where, I don't know if it's 20 customer complaints, 40, I don't know what that inflection point is, but there's a point where they're not going to have any business anymore. They're going to lose all of the clients that they have because people are going to be wise to what's going on with their situation. And the information, it's out there. It's an incredible resource that just nobody knows about.
Dax, it's been great having you. I'm sorry. I think we're out of time. Maybe we can have you back again in the not too distant future if you're amenable to that.
Sure. And I appreciate the time that you guys gave me.
Yeah, it's really good stuff, Dax. And I know that the firm and your managing partner with the White Law Group dedicated to representing victims of investment fraud. And you can learn more at the website whitesecuritieslaw.com, whitesecuritieslaw.com. Fred, it'd be great to have Dax back on. In the meantime, we're back together again next week, getting out the great information on Money Matters USA.
Investment advisory services offered through Money Matters USA, LLC. Fred Sade and his guests provide general information, not individually targeted personalized advice, and are not liable for the usage of information discussed. Exposure to ideas and financial vehicles should not be considered investment advice or a recommendation to buy or sell in any of these financial vehicles. This information should also not be considered tax or legal advice. Individuals should consult with a professional specializing in the fields of tax, legal, accounting, or investments regarding the applicability of this information for their situation. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. Investments will fluctuate and when redeemed may be worth more or less than when originally invested. Any comments regarding safe and secure investments and guaranteed income streams refer only to fixed insurance products. They do not refer in any way to the securities or investment advisory products. Fixed insurance and annuity product guarantees are subject to the claims paying ability of the issuing company and are offered through Money Matters USA, LLC. By contacting Money Matters USA, you may be provided information regarding the purchase of insurance products.